70 to 73 degrees. Northwest winds 5 to 10 could gust higher. And overnight lows from 46 to 50. It's 6 o'clock.
Mean to have the president's former personal lawyer running the Department of Justice. We'll talk with Senator Alex Padilla, one of the lawmakers who vote on Todd Blanch today. That's coming up on Morning Edition from NPR News. What's the punishment for a prosecutor who admitted that her office had no case, Amy Martinez?
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Jeanine Pirro dropped a vandalism charge against a man the president wanted to prosecute. The president is lashing out. Also, how does the memory of the Soviet Union shape the ambitions of Vladimir Putin? It's Tuesday, August 4th. This day in 1984, the Prince album Purple Rain became the number one album in the nation and remained at the top of the charts for 24 weeks. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in New York City, I'm Dwahali Saikautau. Michigan Democrats are voting today for an open Senate seat that could signal the future direction of the party and possibly shape the battle for control of the chamber this fall. NPR's Sam Greenglass reports the primary is seen as a test of how farther left-leaning candidates looking to disrupt the status quo will fare in a battleground state.
Epidemiologist Abdul El-Sayed has the backing of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who won the Michigan primary in 2016. El-Sayed has made criticism of corporate money in politics central.
The problem too often with the Democratic Party is that we have an instinct to say the right thing, but we're bought off by the people who are on the side of doing the wrong thing.
Congresswoman Haley Stevens got late endorsements from Michigan heavyweights like Governor Gretchen Whitmer and retiring Senator Gary Peters.
You know, I'm just beating MAGA four times in my congressional races, and I'm passing laws, and I'm doing damn good work.
Whoever wins will face former Republican Congressman Mike Rogers this fall. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Farmington Hills, Michigan.
Senate Democrats are releasing a report this morning suggesting that big U.S. banks had concerns for years about money moves made by suspected sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. But NPR's Scott Horsley reports the banks are accused of keeping those worries to themselves until after Epstein was arrested.
The report from Democrats on the Senate Finance Committee says more than a dozen bankers at J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Deutsche Bank raised red flags about the money that Epstein was moving around the world. But in most cases, bankers failed to alert the Treasury Department until Epstein was charged with sex trafficking in 2019. Under the Bank Secrecy Act, bankers are supposed to notify the government whenever they suspect a client is moving funds to launder money or carry out other illegal activities. Committee Democrats want the Justice Department to investigate why suspicious activity reports were not filed about Epstein in a more timely manner. They also want to tighten reporting requirements in the future. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Jeanine Pirro, met with President Trump at the White House yesterday, shortly after he told reporters that he was unhappy with her decision to drop charges against a former Olympic athlete accused of vandalizing the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool.
We weren't necessarily thrilled with the contractor, but they did a job and they were fixing any problems. But then it got carried away because the judge was extremely unfriendly to Jeanine. And frankly, I think she choked.
Pirro's decision put her at odds against Trump, a longtime political ally and Trump appointee. The president has not said if he would remove her for Friday's court filing. You're listening to NPR News from New York City. An Israeli official is rejecting criticism from President Trump's Board of Peace envoy, saying Israel must continue to attack Hamas during what was supposed to be a 10-month ceasefire. NPR's Frank Langfitt has the latest from Tel Aviv.
Board of Peace envoy Nikolai Mladenov wrote the following on X on Sunday. Quote, 2 days of strikes across Gaza have killed civilians and destroyed medical supplies that people depend on, end quote. But Doron Spielman, the Israeli Prime Minister's office spokesman, said Israel must keep attacking Hamas to weaken it further.
Just like in any country when they're facing an enemy who wants to kill them, the very first step is removing the ability of that enemy to harm you.
The disagreement highlights the different goals of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Trump, who's seeking a rapid end to the war. More than 73,000 people have been killed in Gaza during the fighting, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Frank Langford, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The highest temperature documented in the last 122 years of South Korean history was recorded this past Sunday in the city of Yangsan. That's northeast of the port city of Busan. The temperature, 108.5 degrees Fahrenheit, or 42.5 degrees Celsius. The record heat wave since May has killed 16 people so far, and Seoul is today bracing for this week's first severe heat wave warning. President Lee Jae-myung told cabinet officials the government needs a fundamental overhaul of what he described as a national crisis since this extreme weather is becoming normal. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Andrew Carnegie Foundation, formerly Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org.
Hey, it's Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition. 50 years ago, KAXE became the first rural public radio station in the nation, serving northern Minnesota. 50 years ago, the first rural public radio station in the United States. Great public radio starts with a mission to serve the community. From Morning Edition to All Things Considered to the local news and the Up North Report, KAXE keeps you informed. The goal is to strengthen civic health in rural northern Minnesota. Let's think about that, civic health, by making local government and elections more understandable and accessible and transparent before, during, and after the vote. So congratulations on 50 years to KAXE.
Your membership has gotten us here to 50 years of KAXE. Do your part. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. The Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to vote today on Todd Blanche's nomination for Attorney General.
This is a step toward Blanche's final confirmation, and he appears to have the majority now that two Republicans have said their objections have been addressed. Blanche made statements relating to a fund that could be paid to the president's political supporters and also a tax immunity deal. In a few moments, we'll hear from a Democrat who sits on that same committee, Senator Alex Padilla of California.
NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas joins us now with more. So, Ryan, for much of the past week, it wasn't really clear whether Blanche's nomination would get through or actually survive. So now the Senate Judiciary Committee is about to vote on it. What changed?
All right. Well, what happened is Blanche and the Justice Department managed to provide the sort of written guarantees that addressed the demands of Senators John Cornyn and Tom Tillis. Now, Cornyn and Tillis are both Republican members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Their support is critical for Blanche's nomination to advance, and they wanted written confirmation that a controversial $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund is dead, and also written limits to a tax immunity deal for Trump, his family, and businesses. Late Sunday, Blanche released two documents that purport to address those. One says it formally rescinds the order that created the anti-weaponization fund, meaning the fund is dead. The other purports to clarify the scope of the tax immunity deal, including that it only applies retroactively and only to Trump, two of his sons, and the Trump Organization. That said, legal experts say neither document that Blanche released is actually legally binding, and they don't provide the sort of ironclad guarantees that they purport to. But they are enough for Cornyn and Tillis, who yesterday thanked Blanche for the assurances and said they would now support his nomination.
Yeah, and typically Republicans rubber stamp the president's nominees. But why was this issue one that really got these two senators to hold up Blanche's nomination?
Well, look, this anti-weaponization fund was deeply unpopular with Republican senators from the very beginning. Remember, this would be $1.8 billion of taxpayer money that the DOJ said could be doled out to, in essence, anyone. That includes rioters who attacked the Capitol on January 6th and beat up cops. The tax immunity deal was also problematic for some Republicans. As Cornyn himself put it last week, that deal would provide Trump with benefits that no other American taxpayer could get. To be clear, those benefits still very much remain in place. It's also worth pointing out that there is a long list of other issues at the Justice Department that legal experts, department veterans think should make Congress question Blanche's leadership, as well as his fitness to be Attorney General.
Okay, such as?
Well, some point to his handling of the Epstein files. You can also look at the department's politicization under Blanche or the targeting of Trump's perceived enemies. But more broadly, there's also the unraveling of what's known as the presumption of regularity, this idea that courts assume that DOJ officials are acting properly, acting in good faith, that they're making accurate factual representations in court. Under this administration, federal judges, we have seen them repeatedly express concerns about the Justice Department not complying with court orders. Judges have questioned the representations that the DOJ has made in court. We have also seen high-profile cases unravel in spectacular fashion just in the past few days. For example, the U.S. Attorney's Office here in D.C. moved to dismiss its felony vandalism case against former Olympic canoeist for damage to the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool. In a court filing, the DOJ said the damage to the reflecting pool wasn't caused by vandalism, but instead was just the result of a botched insulation job. So a dramatic climb down, and as I said, really a long list of issues that raise concerns for many folks about Blanche, and yet these issues haven't really been much of a speed bump at all in his nomination process.
That's NPR's Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thanks.
Thank you.
We've called Democratic Senator Alex Padilla of California, who sits on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Senator, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Ryan Lucas said there that Blanche's statements are not legally binding. Does that mean he could revive the tax deal and the fund that Trump likes?
Well, that's certainly how a lot of us are reading it, Steve. But let's remember the bigger picture here. As I said during his confirmation hearing, Todd Blanche is simply unfit to serve as Attorney General of the United States. He's made no secret about carrying out Trump's political agenda. He shunned any notion that the Attorney General, the Department of Justice, should serve independently of the political priorities of the president. He's been the deputy attorney general for almost a year and a half and acting for the last couple of months, and has carried out the agenda of retribution on behalf of Donald Trump. He bought the Epstein files, as we just discussed a minute ago, this tax immunity deal. Todd Blanche claims he was Donald Trump's personal attorney, but he's continuing to act as if he's still Donald Trump's personal attorney, and the American people deserve better.
You mentioned the tax deal here, and one particular provision of it seems still to be in effect, even if Blanche's notes were binding. He left intact some provisions that would grant broad immunity to the president and his adult children and their business for past conduct. Do you regard that as binding on the next administration, whoever it may be?
No, and some people would. Many people interpret this as not even binding to this administration because it's not a formal legal document or memo. It's a couple of paragraphs. Who knows who drafted them? They were signed by Todd Blanche. The original deal was signed by Todd Blanche after he negotiated with Todd Blanche. He's representing both the president and the Department of Justice. It makes no sense. Nothing to keep this administration from creating another fund by another name for the same purpose tomorrow, maybe most likely right after the November election, if they're doing this to try to evade political consequences as we approach the midterms. And it does nothing to prevent payments to January 6th insurrectionists from other accounts at the Department of Justice. So huge holes in this whole thing. Disappointing to see that Senators Cornyn and Tillis have shifted their opposition to support of Todd Blanche. We're still in opposition on the Democratic side and hoping that there's other Republicans, once this gets to the full Senate, that will step up and do the right thing.
Senators Cornyn and Tillis can say, well, we got these written statements from the Attorney General nominee. What would you say to them?
Yeah, the again, disappointed because these written statements provide no assurances. The vast majority of lawyers will agree Trump's lawyers obviously will disagree.
How much would you say the Department of Justice has changed over the past year and a half? Many people have been fired. Many people have walked out the door. Many offices have been changed. Priorities have been changed. How would you assess the overall change of that agency?
Yeah, it's not a Department of Justice that you would recognize, that most people would recognize. And this was a key theme that I brought up, again, during Todd Blanche's most recent confirmation hearing, the historic independence of the Department of Justice. The people of the United States, the Constitution, is best served when you have an attorney general who will serve and uphold the rule of law independent of the political priorities, certainly priorities of retribution of the President of the United States. When offered a chance to address that, Todd Blanche immediately reverted to, well, this is the executive branch. I serve as the president's lawyers. It is exactly not what the job requires and not what the people expect and deserve.
If we look below the level of Todd Blanche, the acting attorney general, has the personnel of that agency changed dramatically? By which I mean, if there were a Democratic administration in a couple of years, would it be filled with people who take President Trump's view of the law?
There's, it can be a lot of a culture reshifting back to the rule of law, not Democrat, not Republican, but to upholding the Constitution that needs to be repaired in the next administration. This administration has seen a lot of career professionals leave the Department of Justice. They'd rather leave the careers they were proud of than to pledge their loyalty to Donald Trump and his agenda. We've had recruitment problems at the Department of Justice. So I do think once there's a new administration, a new tone of professionalism and respect for the Constitution that's set, we'll recruit back some talent. But in the meantime, American people are paying the price with these priorities that are just in the wrong direction.
What should the Justice Department be doing? What role should it have in the upcoming fall elections, and what role, if any, do you fear it will have?
Well, I think we're close enough to the election where both by letter of the law and by practice, there's nothing that should be done to change the rules or certainly interfere with the administration of the November elections. If the Department of Justice plays a role, it's historically been one that observes to ensure there's no foul play in the elections. Nobody's voting rights are infringed upon. Any eligible voter should be able to register and cast their ballot free from interference or intimidation. So no federal agents roving the polls across America to discourage people from voting. You know, quite the opposite. It should be on alert and uphold people's access to the ballot and the administration of free and fair elections. Because there's so many people that don't have the confidence that this administration and this Department of Justice will do it, others are doing it at the state level, at the local level. In the Senate, we just launched a election observer program in that same spirit.
How confident are you that there will be free and fair elections this fall?
I do feel confident that by and large it will be free and fair elections. As California's former Secretary of State, I know the hard work that state and local elections officials put into, the pride they take in doing their job administering elections, certainly the awareness of the voting public about what may or may not happen, and encouraging voters to exercise all their options. They can vote by mail and avoid any potential conflict or tension at a polling place. You can vote early and not worry about what may or may not happen on Election Day. But on Election Day, plenty of voting rights advocates, either on call or out and about to help protect people and their fundamental right to vote.
Democratic Senator Alex Padilla of California, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
6:19. Thanks for tuning in. This is People Powered KAXE, where we bring you more national news coming up from Morning Edition. Up next, Lila Fadel is speaking with Russia expert Hannah Note about her new book, We Shall Outlast Them. She details there how President Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine is also a war on the West. Weather around our region, it looks like we're going to see some sun today with mild temperatures for an August 4th, high 70 to 73, northwest winds 5 to 10, gusting higher, overnight lows 46 to 50, and sunny with highs in the mid to upper 70s for tomorrow. We receive support from Sanford Bemidji Heart and Vascular Center, expanding cardiology services to our region, more at sanfordhealth.org. And thanks also to Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, with both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. Coming up, Nature Talkbacks. What have you been seeing in nature? You can text us this morning, 218-326-1234. Thanks goes out to Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. RapidsBrewingCO.com.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing real stories with supporting data through its podcast After the Fact, exploring how people find solutions to some of today's biggest issues. From the University of Maryland Libraries, dedicated to making UMD's research available to everyone and advancing open access for the public good. More at lib.umd.edu. And from the Carnegie Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. We shall outlast them. Those were the words of Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev for the West during a speech he gave in Moscow in 1956. Communism, he vowed, would outlast capitalism. 70 years on, are Khrushchev's words still a guiding light for Russia's policies, even after the fall of the Soviet Union? Russia expert Hannah Note argues yes in her new book, We Shall Outlast Them. It details the many ways Russia has set out to expand its global influence, including framing the full-scale invasion of Ukraine as a war against the West and its decadence. That kind of propaganda, Note writes, is key to Russia's expanding influence. She sets out to answer the question, why does Russia's messaging resonate?
The sources of pro-Russian affinity have formed as layers of storytelling about past rights and past wrongs. Russia appeals to some because the Soviet Union was a friend, to others because the West is hypocritical, because woke ideas unsettle them, or because democracy no longer delivers, because the status quo, however defined, is bad.
Why has Russia been so successful in the story it tells about itself?
Russia has framed the war that it is waging as an anti-neocolonial war. So according to that story, the West is using Ukraine as a proxy in order to dismantle Russia, and Russia is standing up against the imperial West. And that story resonates in other parts of the world, for example, in Africa, because countries there have their own experiences with Western oppression. And one of the reasons why Russia is quite successful in doing so is that it has really gone on the offensive in disseminating this kind of propaganda. Russian media has really spread its tentacles in Africa, in Latin America, in the Middle East.
But why does that work when you look at what it's doing in Ukraine, a sovereign state, but also the more quiet interventions across Eastern Europe, Africa, and the Middle East?
What Russia is doing in Ukraine is not seen through the prism of colonialism and occupation. And, you know, I have this feeling that the reason for that is that colonialism is not something that white people are doing to other white people in Europe. And there's also a perception of the war in Ukraine as a war that is ultimately one that the West is at fault for.
Hmm. In another part of your book, you write about President Donald Trump and you call him disruptor in chief.
Mm-hmm.
You write that him as an anti-interventionist, an anti-liberal and anti-globalist leader has given Russia some space in its campaign to outlast the West. But also, Trump is an unpredictable leader. So is it something that Russia can really depend on long term?
I think the anti-interventionism and anti-globalism in Donald Trump's campaign promised to give Russia some space in its campaign to outlast the West. But the way that U.S. foreign policy has played out in action over the last 18 months mm-hmm. has actually meant that many of Russia's hopes did not materialize. They welcomed the promise of a normalization in the U.S.-Russia relationship. But then if we look at the practice of U.S. foreign policy, of course, we see that Donald Trump has ordered the use of military force against many countries, including Russian partners, Venezuela and Iran. And even though Donald Trump has rolled out the red carpet for Vladimir Putin, there has been no meaningful normalization in the Russia-U.S. relationship or real gains from a Russian point of view.
What about when it comes to that propaganda war? Are there things that the West, the United States, is doing that feeds this story that Russia tells about the role of the West and the ills of the world?
Well, I do think that the handling of the war in Gaza and this unequivocal support that countries in Europe and the United States led to Israel really made it much easier for Russia to tell a story of Western hypocrisy, of Western double standard, of caring about human rights in some parts of the world and not in others. And Russia really tapped into those grievances quite opportunistically.
I mean, I do remember very specific interviews with Palestinians where they would point that out. How can you see occupation and invasion and oppression in Ukraine and not see it with us? A refrain I heard often.
Right.
Has Putin's, though, laser focus on Ukraine disrupted its larger strategy of domination that we saw through both military backing and propaganda over the years? And I'm thinking of the sort of crumbling of its influence in Syria when Bashar al-Assad fell, the disruption of that in places like Armenia and beyond.
In some ways, yes, but it's a mixed picture. If we compare Russia's position in the world today to what it was in January 2022, before Russia invaded Ukraine, Russia's global influence has declined.
Mm-hmm.
In 2022, Russia had it pretty good. It had strained but still functional relations with Europe and the United States. It had a solid military presence in Syria, in the South Caucasus. It had good relations with China. Now, relations with Europe have totally unraveled. Russia's position in the Middle East has eroded. And the relationship between Russia and China has become a lot more asymmetrical because Russia has become so heavily dependent on China because of Western sanctions. And unless this war ends and something changes dramatically, this trajectory of deepening dependence on China will only continue.
Do you see a future where this does change?
At the moment, I don't think that President Putin is ready to walk away from this war. Until there is domestic political change inside Russia, Russia looks at itself as a global power. It retains the ambition to project power into other parts of the world.
Hannah Note is the director of the Eurasia Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. Her book, We Shall Outlast Them, is out today. Hannah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
Far out in the Pacific Ocean, more than a million square miles of ocean are federally protected. Now the Trump administration is opening some of those areas to commercial fishing.
These places are just so special and so unique that it's really incumbent upon us to make sure that they're here for future generations.
I'm Elsa Chang, a rare trip to a remote Pacific island on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear that news coverage coming up this afternoon, 4 o'clock, all things considered, here on People Powered KAXE. It is almost 6:30. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer. Boy, are we people powered.
Indeed we are.
After last week.
What a week.
Saturday night finished up our summer membership drive. Folks still, though, were out of town or they might have missed it, and they've been sending us pledges since then. We almost made it to our goal. We don't have the final figures yet. We had a lofty goal of $50,000 for 1 week to keep KEXE rolling, and you came through. We thank you so much for doing that.
Absolutely. And Tuesday morning was fabulous, as always. It humbles me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've got a lot going on this morning. I'm excited about... heard from folks this week. We also start a new series with our producer, Mark Jacobs.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it. And we're going to be talking to some old friends of mine. And I look forward to talking to the Plinskys about the Master Naturalist program that they are actively a part of. So that'll be a fun conversation. There's going to be a lot of things going on. And I understand our question of the week is, how do you like your berries? And I'm
in your belly.
I'm with the bears on this one. Or the video you sent me of the fox. My dog is the same. I think all canids probably are aware of the taste of raspberries. I've never had a dog that didn't want to eat them. I've watched rough grouse eat them. I've seen a video of fox eating them, but they're like me. They, you know, oh, there's one, I'll eat that one. I went out for a walk yesterday, and in an hour and a half, I probably ate a cup and a half or 2 cups of raspberries, but that's exactly what I did. I ate them 2 or 3 at a time. Oh, there's some ripe ones, I'll eat those. Yeah, I'm not the guy you want to send out for pie filling.
Last week I had the luck of a friend of a friend who was going to be out of town and was going to miss all their blueberry picking.
Oh.
They told me the location.
Ooh.
And we got to head out there one day last week, which was really nice. Got a whole bunch, and they're, man, are they good. But I also just, we ate them and then just frozen plain to put in oatmeal.
Yeah.
You know? It would make one pie. And I want a piece of pie. I don't want a full pie necessarily, if that makes sense. I mean,
Don't all my blueberries at once.
Yeah, I do. Wait, we made blueberry pancakes that were so good.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, so. My grandson is real fond of blueberry pancakes. So, but the chipmunks, I think, got my blueberries this year. I don't know. Mm. There were some coming on the plants. I have some varietals, some domestic varietals. And some of the plants had produced some berries, and they were getting ripe, and then I would go by, and there would be fewer and fewer and fewer, and the same thing happened to my June berries. So, we'll be talking about June berries on the phenology portion of the show today, among other things.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you today. You can text us 218-326-1234. Looks like it's going to be a lovely day, mostly sunny, highs near 70. Southwest winds 5 to 10, gusting up to 20. Mostly clear with lows 47 to 52 tonight. Love it. West winds 5 to 50.
I might have to go looking for a blanket.
Yeah. Sunny for tomorrow. Highs in the mid to upper 70s. Increasing clouds overnight with lows 54 to 60 by Thursday. Sunny with highs 80 to 85 across the region. And overnight lows near 60. Coming up, we've got National Native News at 9 o'clock today. It is Headwaters with Kari Headland.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. Efforts to encourage more Native Americans to vote are underway in more than a dozen states this year. Chuck Hornbach reports on how things are going in Wisconsin ahead of the state primary contest on August 11th.
The nonpartisan group Wisconsin Native Vote is about a decade old and is now up to 4 organizers around the state. They've already been doing outreach at powwows and a variety of other community events. Spokesperson and organizer Ann Egan Walkaw is a member of the Menominee tribe. She says a key message is that voting is a way to make sure Native voices are heard.
we tell people to vote for the seventh generation. That's what really resonates with people, because our ancestors worked to make sure Mother Earth was clean, healthy for us, and it's our job to do that for the next seven generations. But also, it's working to make sure we retain our sovereignty.
Egan Walker says tribal sovereignty is an especially powerful theme for the Menominee, which only won back full tribal status in the early 1970s after much activism and debate with state and federal elected officials. Still, this is not a presidential election year, and Wisconsin only has high-profile races for governor, the House of Representatives, and state legislature. Statewide voter turnout is expected to be down from 2024. But Egan Walker says there are some big problems, new and ongoing, likely to motivate tribal members to vote.
Like, we had listening sessions and people came to talk to us about issues that are important to them, like the data centers, you know, the opioid problem that we have on our reservations.
Egan Walker says she does encounter people who are cynical about voting and politicians, but she says she asks them, do they really want to do nothing at election time? For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
The Kluna tribe's powwow and potlatch happens only once every 2 years, but when it does, it draws hundreds and hundreds of people to the village of Ikluna, a few miles north of Anchorage. The weekend of dancing, drumming, and feasting kicked off Saturday at the tribe's powwow grounds. Aaron Leggett, the president of the native village of Ikluna, says that what makes him most proud is that no one leaves hungry because the tribe feeds everyone.
We'll have moose, various types of moose stew and roast and fish, salmon. It's just sort of our way of really being open and good community partners.
Many also bring dishes to share. Leggett says the tribe had plenty to celebrate this year, including the groundbreaking for its long-awaited gathering hall, funded in part by the success of its new casino. But more than anything, Leggett says the gathering is a chance for Anchorage, Chugiak, and Eagle River to get to know their neighbors in the village of Ikluna.
There are certainly people that wouldn't necessarily, you know, when they think of Ikluna, maybe they would think of the cemetery and the church, but don't really have any other sense of it. The powwow potlatch really was our way of increasing awareness to the community and building that up.
The theme for this year's event was Restoring Our River 97 Years Later. It highlighted the tribe's efforts to restore the natural flow of the Ikluna River and its wild salmon runs. This story was provided by KMBA's Rhonda McBride. On this day in 1795, the Treaty of Greenville was signed, ending the Northwest Indian War. The agreement between the United States and several tribal nations ceded much of the present-day Ohio to the United States, marking a major turning point in federal-tribal relations and westward expansion. I'm Jill Freitas.
Sunday evening on the street corners, serenade African, black, and French Creole, Delta blues and Caribbean soul. Different folks with different names, the love of the music was all the same. Celebrating, celebrating a life of love. Celebrating, celebrating a life. There's no trouble we can't rise above. Your heart ain't heavy when you dance, so take every chance you can to celebrate living a life of love. We cook it all up in a soulful stew. All the spices are there for you, and spread that feeling the whole world round. People find joy in the soulful sound. Songs that bring us all back home with a rhythm that you've always known. Celebrate.
trouble we can't rise above. Your heart ain't heavy when you dance, so take every chance you can just to celebrate living a life of love. Celebrating, celebrating a life of love.
That is an album that has just been released. It was recorded in 2010 from Taj Mahal and the Phantom Blues Band. We heard Life of Love.
Yeah, Taj Mahal. That boy liked to fish. He came up to northern Minnesota fairly often because he liked to fish.
And you got to see him perform as KFC?
I did, yeah. I saw him play both here and up north at a place called Jack Pine Junction, which is no more. But
okay.
Yeah, he was a regular visitor up here and played a lot of music in the area, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah. You hear music, you hear news, you hear nature reports. That's what's coming up next here on the Tuesday morning show. It's People Powered KAXE. Folks are continuing to support us. If you happen to miss the summer membership drive we ended up on Saturday night, we thank you so much for being a part of that, for telling people about it. Lots of people were adding to their sustaining memberships and making it possible. We want to especially thank the Tuesday morning folks who came through with a match,
man,
beforehand.
Yeah.
And then that morning with so many things coming in.
Wow.
It just got everybody going for the entire week. We just heard yesterday from Karen from Bemidji, who wanted to make sure she got in to donate. And we'd love to hear from you as well. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
There is never a bad time to call and donate at 326-1234.
We just don't talk about it as much during the
and that's
season,
okay,
you know?
Too, because, yes, you know, we do, it's invigorating. It's it's an enthusiastic thing, but it is also it's hard. It's you struggle to find new ways to supplicate.
Well, I don't think
I do anyway.
I don't know about you, John, but I wouldn't sell something unless I cared about it. This is the only thing that I can do this sort of thing for, because I believe so strongly in KXE.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's true. It does. I made the error of thinking that I might be a salesman at one point in my life, and found out that you have to really have, you just have to have a hide about a foot thick, and you've got to have that, okay, not you, then the next guy kind of attitude. And you do have to believe in what it is you're selling. And I do believe in what it is I'm selling. And I won't call it an understanding of nature, maybe just an appreciation of nature, just an opportunity to take a moment, even if it's only 30 seconds out of your life, and stop and look at something or see something. The Carolina grasshoppers that are flying about everywhere right now. I talked about them this morning on the Daily Dose of Phenology, and they are out there right now in large numbers. And boy, if you're a kid, when I was a kid, we called them pretty wingers. We didn't know their names, but they were the grasshoppers that had the pretty wings. And boy, one of those would fly and there'd be six kids chasing it, you know, and we'd chase that thing for a half hour, wear it out and finally catch it and then look it over, pull its wings out and look at its wings and see the intricate folding that happens in there. And nature is fascinating. And I can sell that idea to people because even if you only take a tiny dose of it now and then, it's still worth your while.
Yeah, it sure is. We are, I've been telling you, I think, about the, that we had a wood duck. We thought that there were some babies at the duck house. Well, the mother goes in. We see him going in, but nothing has come out. No jumpers yet. It feels like it's a little too long from what we've been looking up.
Yeah, so. It doesn't seem right.
But they
it's a 30
come back to visit?
Unless she's trying to, you know, keep the nest as her own.
Yeah.
You know, keep other ducks from taking it over.
Okay.
I would say, August, that's late. Okay. If little babies were jumping out of there now, they would have a tough time being flight ready by the time mom and dad would say, hey, let's go south.
Nature breaks your heart, too.
It does. I walked by the eagle's nest yesterday and no eagle.
Mm.
It fledged. And it doesn't need the nest anymore. It's out in the wilds learning how to hunt and fish and eat. And I'm okay with that because I know that it got to that stage. And that's the first time in like 3 years that I've had fledged an eagle out of that nest. I think that, I don't know. I speculate that, that maybe it was one of them was new to the job. One of the parents maybe might have been new to the job. You know, the nest has been there since 1985, and no eagle lives that long. That's just too long. 26 and 15 is 41. That'd be about 6 years longer than any eagle would be expected to live, even in the best of conditions. And so I'm sure there's been a turnover there. And I don't know, maybe the new eagle was just not, you know, maybe the one of them, mother, dad, I don't know. Maybe they weren't quite adapted to what it takes to raise a young eagle. But now this year they did manage to raise one. There were two in the nest to start with. One perished, but the other survived. And I saw it learn to fly and fly off. But I talked to Dallas Hudson last night, and Dallas told me, you know, at his nest, the same thing happened. But that they come back, you know, periodically. It's like, maybe I'll spend the night at the nest and, you know, see what's going on.
There you go.
Listen to that old man snore.
Coming up, we've got more. We've got talkbacks, people we heard from this week, nature sightings. You're always welcome to join that conversation by texting in to 218-326-1234. I want to remind you that county fairs are kicking up across the region. Today begins the Crowing County Fair in Brainerd, and Clearwater County Fair begins tomorrow, and that goes through the weekend. Also, Chisholm has the St. Louis County Fair, and that starts on Wednesday as well. So lots of things going on.
All right. Well, get your chickens all dusted off and get them to the fair so you can claim that blue ribbon.
You gotta iron your white shirt. So you can show your chicken, you know,
those
kids there. It's one of my favorite things ever.
My son won
ribbons
at the fair with his chickens. Yeah. He was.
We used to volunteer with 4-H so we could be a part of it and just see it. When I would tell people that, they'd be like, wow, you're judging chickens. I'm like, no, that's a very serious role that is from the state. Right? It's a guy in a lab coat, for crying out loud. I was just writing people's names down. I can't judge them.
I don't know what the qualifications are for being a judge of chickens, but I do know that that chickens are pretty amazing. And after an absence of 20 years or thereabouts, my son has chickens again, and you can just see it in his attitude. He's back to where he likes to be.
Nice. I also want to remind folks that a week from today is Minnesota's primary election. Early voting is open right now. The KXC News team has put together a 2026 primary election guide. You can learn about the candidates running to represent you in Washington, St. Paul, and here at home. Go to kexc.org/election guide. And new this year is printable versions. You can help us out by sharing election information with your friends and neighbors.
It is time for our Phenology Talkbacks, and our talkbacks are produced by our own Charlie Mitchell and Heidi Holton, not by me, because anything that is electronic and I touch, it generally fails. Last night was no exception. It just is one of those things about me that you should know. If you're tired of answering your cell phone, just hand it to me. It will break in my hand. At any rate, our talkbacks are produced by Charlie Mitchell and Heidi Holton. And our first report this week comes from Long Lake Conservation Center near Palisade.
Hi, this is Helen,
Bella,
and Macy. During astronomy camp at Long Lake Conservation Center from July 31st through August 3rd, the temps were a pleasant high of 83 degrees Fahrenheit and a low of 54. Some haze from wildflowers blew in, turning the waxing gibbous moon a brilliant red. It didn't help stargazing, but it sure was beautiful. Other extraterrestrial sightings included clear views of the Milky Way, the Big and Little Dipper, Cassiopeia, Orion, a double star, and sunspots we saw through the Hydrogen Alpha Solar Telescope.
Through the Minnesota Astronomical Society 25 and 30-inch Dobsonian telescopes, we saw the Lagoon Nebula, Ring Nebula, Dunbell Nebula, Swan Nebula, the Whirlpool Galaxy, and the Hercules Cluster. Thanks to Minnesota Astronomical Society for sharing the universe with us.
In terrestrial sightings, we saw a large snapping turtle in the lake. We enjoyed hearing loons calling at night. We saw a cicada, Delta 1 panther, woodchuck, chipmunks, dragonflies, a garter snake, a bumblebee asleep on flowers, a tiny frog, a katydid, and a hummingbird moth. We also saw a fawn and a doe. The fawn was a third size of the doe and still had clearly visible spots. We had a great week of camp, and we want to remind everyone to unplug, get outside, look up, and
live connected.
Yeah, look up. That sounds like a fun camp. Those kids... By the way, thank you, Helen, Bella, and Macy, for that great report. But the things that they got to see, the waxing moon, clear views of the Milky Way, Big and Little Dipper, Cassiopeia, Orion, and looking at sunspots through a hydrogen alpha solar telescope. I had not heard of such a thing. 25 and 30-inch Dobsonian telescopes, Lagoon Nebula, Ring Nebula, Dumbbell Nebula, Swan Nebula, Whirlpool Galaxy, and the Hercules Cluster. Wow. Those are things that I would not be able to point out to you in the sky. Some of the constellations, perhaps, but those nebulae would be awfully tricky for me. Snapping turtles... Loons, cicadas, downy woodpeckers, woodchucks, chipmunks, dragonflies, bumblebees, tiny frog. I wonder if the tiny frog was just a small frog or if it was a frog that's tiny like the Hylacrucifer, the spring peeper. There it is. Sometimes my brain works that way. Or the chorus frog. Those are both really small frogs, even in their biggest size. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting. Our next report comes from Alex, who was a visitor at Sugar Lake Lodge.
This is Alex Buckle, a wildlife professional, bat researcher, and wetland delineator from Texas. I just finished a great nature walk with John Latimer. You name the area of expertise, he knows at least something about it. We learned some entomology, some herpetology, some botany, a little bit of freshwater ecology. It was extremely cool stuff. We had people in our group with quite a bit of knowledge, and then people who were starting from scratch, and John knew how to talk to everyone at their level. It was a really, really great nature walk. Such a fun experience. We caught some damselflies and some frogs and some dragonflies. Got me fired up about the natural world. That's the entire point.
Well, I didn't ask Alex to put in such a kind word about me. I was hoping he'd talk more about the damselflies and the frogs. And actually, Alex, interesting guy and an expert, did his PhD work on bats in Texas and knew a great deal about bats. So we had a long conversation about the local bats and about the bats in Texas and just really had a nice time together. That exposure that I get out there is so incredible. I got a chance to talk to a woman who was working on a PhD studying mosquitoes and the flowers that they use for reproduction. And some mosquitoes lay their eggs in flowers, and that's where they are. That's where the babies are born. And this woman was studying those and the signals that those flowers give off with the hopes that they would be able to develop then maybe a synthetic version of that scent, whatever it is that brings that mosquito to that flower. If they could develop a synthetic version of that flower, then they could bring the mosquito to a place where they would lay their egg and no little mosquito would come from it. It's kind of a tricky thing that they're doing, but hey, it's working out for them. Our next report comes from Duane, who is also a visitor at Sugar Lake Lodge.
This is Duane Bin, out at Sugar Lake Lodge with John Latimer. He was an amazing naturalist that showed us the intersection between the Sugar Lake, the Siskiyou.
Siskiyou
Lake, and how it intersects with the little sloughs that we have here and little wetland areas and some of the consumers that we have, such as the some damselflies, dragonflies, some of the wood frogs, leopard frogs, and just showing that intersection between that habitat and then as you go further into the forest and some of the local trees, the deciduous trees, the pines, some of the unique qualities of those species that sort of make up this area of this part of Minnesota. He's an amazing naturalist that goes beyond just identification, but shows some of the unique adaptations that some of these trees and individual animals have. And he continues to keep the group in awe as he gives them facts upon facts upon facts.
Oh, another pat on the back. I don't know if I can take this. It's starting to hurt my shoulders. Duane, thank you for those kind words. I was hoping Duane might speak more broadly about some of the things that we ran into, the damselflies, dragonflies, frogs. But Duane is the superintendent of a large natural area in the San Diego area of California. And he and I had a long discussion about the amazing place that he works. And hopefully I'll be able to visit and be able to pay him back by saying all those kind things about him as well. Two interesting fellows, those last two reports. Our next report comes from Jaden. Jaden, a bit younger and also a hiker with us at Sugar Lake Lodge.
My name is Jaden. I'm from Polk City, Iowa. We went on a nature hike today, and when I saw a grasshopper, we caught a frog, and I caught two minnows.
Now that's more like it, Jaden. Thanks. No praise for the guy leading the group, but a lot of fun. And Jaden, pretty interesting young fellow. I loaned him a net, and I'm sure by now he has caught much more than what he caught there. But he was the first kid of any that I went with that actually caught the minnows in the creek. And it was...